Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to welcome my guest, Professor Sally Bloomfield. Doing these podcasts, I get to meet fascinating people and go to bed that night less dumb. And Professor Bloomfield is certainly going to help with my education. Sally started her education at the University of Nottingham with a pharmacy degree, followed by her PhD at the same institution. And she's also a member of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society and was awarded the Rudolf Schülke Hygiene Prize for outstanding contributions in the field of hygiene and preventive medicine. She's a consultant in infectious disease and hygiene and an honorary professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Her interest in hygiene has taken her into the world of antimicrobial resistance, a really important topic we've discussed before. And today, Sally will provide her unique perspectives. Welcome, Professor Bloomfield.
Hello, it's nice to be with you.
We're delighted you can join us. So, Sally, until 1997, you were an academic in the pharmacy department at King's College, working on infection prevention and the use of antimicrobial agents. What made you leave academia to join Unilever research?
Well, whilst I was doing my research, I began to get sort of diverted into the fact that, very few people were researching about hygiene in our home settings and in our everyday lives. And that was regrettable. Because what had happened around 1970, we said, oh, okay, we've got vaccines, we've got antibiotics, we really don't need hygiene anymore. It's not necessarily. And the Surgeon General in the United States said, oh, it's time to turn to close the book on infectious disease. You know, within 20 years, infectious disease will be a thing of the past. Pardon? And during the 1990s, it was becoming clear that, I mean, hospitals had revived their interest in hygiene. As you know, if it hadn't been for that, you wouldn't have been able to do your endoscopic work because you wouldn't have been able to sterilize your endoscopes. Yeah, but there was still this feeling, oh, well, you know, the home's really not important. You know, people are fit and healthy. Why do we need home hygiene? But it was becoming very, very clear to me that that wasn't the case. You know, we were beginning to see antimicrobial resistance, and if we couldn't use antibiotics anymore, we were going to have to revert to hygiene. We were beginning to see more and more vulnerable groups, older people living in the community, more care of people in the community, more people living in the community who were very vulnerable to infection, people like people with HIV/AIDS. And then going on now, actually, into the 2000s, the potential for global pandemics. And there they were setting up these strategies. And it was very clear that they were saying in the event of a global pandemic, hygiene in home and everyday life is going to be critical to mitigating spread until we can put pharmaceutical measures in place. And hasn't that proved to be the case? So when Unilever came to me and said, look, we believe that we've got to do more than just sell disinfectants and cleaning products. We need to start thinking about what home hygiene really means. Would you like to come and join us and do this? Well, it was a no-brainer. So I changed and went and did it.
And what were some of the projects that you did there, Sally? Like working with, you know, a large multinational that, as you say, makes a lot of products. What was your brief?
Well, the brief was it was a professional program. So our job was to set up a program to talk not directly to the public, but people who are responsible for talking to the public. So that was scientists, opinion formers, policymakers, health professionals, the media, all those sort of people. And to do that, we started with, which industry does, as you, I suspect, know, started with an advisory panel. We put together an advisory panel of experts on home hygiene, and we met at regular intervals. And we were very sure in our own minds that there really was a need for action. So we approached Unilever and said, would you enable us to set up an NGO, an educational trust? It's totally not about selling products. It's about selling hygiene. Would you, support us to do this? And indeed, they said yes. So along came the birth of our organization, the International Scientific Forum on Home Hygiene.
So tell us about that. What were the, when one starts such an organization, there's always like some guiding principles, some aims. Tell us about the IFH, the International Scientific Forum on Home Hygiene.
Oh, it was a real baptism of fire for me, because you go from being a scientist to becoming a communicator. You know, how do you put science into practice? And I really had to learn fast about, you know, how you set up a communications program, which was really, really interesting. So really, we had two fundamental aims. One was raising awareness of the importance of hygiene in home and everyday life, in tackling antimicrobial resistance, pandemics, you know, whatever. And really saying, making sure that hygiene in home and everyday life was no longer the poor relation, which is what it has become, if you think about it. And then the second was to develop hygiene based on sound science that was relevant to what we where we now find ourselves in the 21st century with all of these issues. You know, really during the early 20th century, it was all about diphtheria and TB and gastrointestinal diseases and stuff. It's changed so much these days, you know, that a lot of it is viral and not amenable to antibiotics. And so it has to be hygiene that's appropriate to the 21st century. And that's what we've tried to do.
Would you like to expand a little bit on both of those issues? So, and, you know, give us some examples of, about raising awareness of importance of home hygiene and everyday life. And I know you've talked a bit about timing, the importance of, you know, there are times to be hygienic, if you will.
Yeah, yes. And I think you've hit on the key thing, which is really up until... and still, the idea about hygiene, and it's what I call the Florence Nightingale approach, and she wasn't wrong, you know, that it's cleanliness, it's all preventing infectious disease is all about cleanliness. And of course, remember, she lived in an age where there was no germ theory of disease, where they were still talking about miasma.
Yes, it predated it. Right.
Predated everything. And so, you know, it was all about, well, if we keep our environments clean, you know, spotlessly clean, then we can prevent infections. And she proved it, you know, in the Crimean War. And she took those ideas right on into the 20th century. But what we've realized now is that that's a very blunt instrument, you know, to try and separate ourselves from our microbial world. And we'll hopefully talk about that later, is just impossible. So what we have to do is to develop something called targeted hygiene, where we decide, you know, where are the risks? What are the situations? When are the times when we are likely to be exposed to harmful microbes? Focusing our hygiene efforts at those times and places. So it's moving away from the idea that hygiene is about keeping our homes clean and free from germs, to saying hygiene is about preventing the journey of the germ from an infected source like food or other people, such that we become infected. It sounds as if they're the same, but they're not. They are totally different.
Interesting. So the International Forum has a website. I believe it's, if people want to learn more, it's IFH, F for Foxtrot, IFH-homehygiene.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Excellent, excellent. So you've mentioned antimicrobial resistance, or AMR. It's a current and growing threat. And there are many ways to address this, some of which we've discussed before on this podcast. New molecules, the responsible use of antibiotics, avoiding antibiotics in the food chain, and so on. But what role does hygiene play in AMR?
It's the same role as it plays in the hospital environment, really. First of all, it's about trying to reduce antibiotic prescribing. And the more that we can get people to practice good hygiene, the less likely they are to get an infection and the less likely they are to run to their doctor and ask for a prescription for antibiotics. And I think it's going to be really interesting when we look back at COVID and the first 6 months of this year. You know, people are worrying about the fact, oh, we've been using too many antibiotics in hospitals and we're going to get a surge in antibiotic resistance. But what people aren't thinking about is that if people have been practicing good hygiene to prevent the spread of COVID, they're at the same time preventing the spread of other infections.
Indeed.
And I'm very interested to see whether we see evidence of reduced antibiotic prescribing in the community as a result of COVID. So that's one aspect. And of course, the other aspect is that we know it's a revolving door. You know, we don't just get antimicrobial resistant strains inside hospitals. People bring them out with them and they then spread them around. And there's a lot of evidence now showing the prevalence of antimicrobial resistance strains, which are silently spreading in the community. People are carrying them. They're not ill. But when they become ill, or when they pass it on to somebody else that becomes ill, then they're not just getting that infection, they're getting an antimicrobial resistance infection. So hygiene is going to play a huge part. And what worries us is that if you look at all the countries in the world, they're all, we've got the WHO policies, but we've got country-based policies. And all of these policy documents do talk about the importance of hygiene outside hospitals as well as inside hospitals. But if you get down into the nitty-gritty of those policy papers, they give very little in terms of what we should be doing to improve hygiene outside hospitals. And I think the UK is unique in that case, in that they are saying quite openly in their last year's five-year action plan, the government can only do so much when it comes to preventing infections. The community has a huge role to play. So, you know, they're on our side. But I think a big lobbying job is needed to actually, you know, get recognition of this. And I don't know why, because it seems so obvious to me that you can't stop infections in hospitals without also stopping in the community. I don't know if you agree with me.
Totally. And you made a very interesting point. You made lots of interesting points. But the comment about how our behaviours during this pandemic will have longer term impacts, things like people now being aware about the importance of washing their hands and not touching their face. I'm wondering how many other things will change. And of course, in the UK, doctors don't wear, you know, surgeons are told you shouldn't wear a tie because of the risk of nosocomial infection transmission. Your tie touches a patient, then goes and touches another patient, and wearing grubby lab coats. So it does require a whole rethink, doesn't it, Sally?
I think so. And I think, you know, we've been promoting this business of targeted hygiene since the 1990s quite widely. But just in the last year, we've had the opportunity to do some consumer polling. And what we've realised is that consumers, if you say, you know, we need targeted hygiene, oh, yeah, yes, we understand that. Yes. But when it comes to it, they don't really understand what you mean. What they want to target are the places that are dirty, because they think that's where germs lurk. What we've been doing is trying to find out, you know, what people do, people understand hygiene, and do they understand this idea of targeted hygiene, where you're trying to stop the journey of the germ? And you find, oh, wait a minute, they think they do, but they don't. What they want to do is to target places that they think, they say, oh, I understand target hygiene. Yes. Now tell me, where are the risky places where germs are going to lurk? And you say, oh, wait a minute. So in the last 12 months, we've had to turn this around to start with the moments. And we've thought about, when are the moments in our lives when harmful microbes are most likely to be spreading? And once we can get those over, then we can start talking about places. So do you want me to give you some examples of what we think of?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Right, absolutely.
Okay. We reckon there are nine that are the most important. One of the obvious ones is the toilet, using the toilet. But I say using the toilet. It's not about disinfecting the toilet. It's how we use it. It's when we use it, it becomes a risk. So it's about making sure that not only do we keep the toilet clean, but that's mostly done by flushing. That's why we invented toilets. It's about making sure that we, as far as possible, keep the things we touch in the toilet hygienically clean, things like the toilet seat, the flush handle, the tap handles, and obviously washing our hands. So all of those work together. That moment of that moment for hygiene, when we are depositing the contents of our colon, which may be infected, into the toilet, making sure that those organisms don't spread. The next one is obviously food, you know, handling food, knowing that the raw food that we buy, particularly meat and poultry, but also vegetables, that when we're handling it, is handled safely so that the organisms don't spread. And also when we're eating food, because we're often eating food, you know, at any time of the day. If we're eating food with our fingers, then anything that's on our fingers is likely to contaminate the food and go into our mouth. Then there's, for example, there's touching surfaces frequently touched by other people. And that's become so important in COVID, because as soon as you get into crowded places, there's not just this risk of airborne transmission, that if you're in a crowded place, if you've got some of the organism on your hands and you touch the surface and someone else touches it and they touch their face, then these surfaces are great spreaders of infection. Laundry, obviously, if somebody's infected, then they can pass it on to other family members via clothing and household linens. So when we're handling and laundering our clothing, that's another moment for hygiene. Disposing of refuse. Refuse may be contaminated with harmful organisms, particularly food refuse. Looking after our pets. Yes, okay, our pets are wonderful for our health, but we must respect them and recognise that they can carry microbes that are harmful to us. And then finally, the ninth moment is really when someone in the home is either infected or is more vulnerable to infection for some reason. And that's when all the other eight moments apply. It's just that if we don't comply with those moments for hygiene, then they're more likely to be infected. So that's trying to get into people's minds that whenever they're doing one of those actions, these are the times when I must be more careful. It's the time when I need to practice good hygiene. So shall I give you just an example to say what I mean by that?
Absolutely. Yes, please do give us an example.
Well, for example, if you're preparing a chicken in your kitchen, okay, you obviously you've got to assume, we know that maybe up to 50 to 60% of chickens have got either salmonella or campylobacter on them. As we're preparing that chicken, where do the organisms go? It's very obvious if you think about it. They go onto our hands, they go onto the utensils, they go onto the chopping board, any other surfaces that, you know, the chicken comes into contact. So that's the moment for hygiene. But what are the places? Because we said it's the times and the places that matter. Well, it's all of those things. So if we make sure that we clean the chopping board and clean the utensils, which we can do in the sink and, you know, with hot soapy water and rinsing. And if we then wash our hands and wipe any other surfaces and disinfect them, then what we've actually done at that moment is contain that risk. And once we've contained that risk through dealing with those critical points, we don't need to disinfect the rest of the kitchen. So targeted hygiene is all about the moment that matters, handling raw food, and the places that matter, those things that are coming in contact with the raw food. It's so obvious when you think about it, but we're still so hung up on this idea. Where are the places I need to clean in my kitchen? Oh, it's the places that are dirty. And it was very interesting. We were doing some surveys of people's perceptions of risk. And it was very interesting that 60% of people, when they were asked, you know, what do you think is the risk from not using an antimicrobial cleaner on your floors and of your kitchen and bathroom? And about 60% thought that was a risk. And at the same number, 60% of people said, I always use an antimicrobial product when I clean the floors of my kitchen and bathroom. Even though you're not going to, if there might be some germs there, you might come into, you're unlikely to come into contact with them. But then same way, when it came to the dishcloth, which is a wonderful instrument for spreading germs around the kitchen, only about 50% thought that was a risk. And I think it was less than that, said they actually clean their dishcloth between each use. So we're still hooked up on this idea. Tell me where are the dirty places, and because that's where germs lurk. So that's what targeted hygiene is about. It's trying to move us away to understanding that we're trying to block the journey of the germ. There is another organisation which is called the Global Hygiene Council, which has been set up to, again, promoting globally good hygiene practice in home and everyday life. And what they did was to last year was to invest in setting up a consensus group of experts, global experts from right across the world, from India right across down into South Africa, into Asia, into North America and Europe, they brought us together for a day and we debated, obviously, these issues. And from that, we've prepared a consensus paper, which is published, I think, on the 8th of September. And what it does is to review why we believe hygiene is so important in home and everyday life in terms of tackling antimicrobial resistance, and also what we believe to be appropriate hygiene for the 21st century to tackle this issue. So it talks in depth about targeted hygiene. So it's going to provide us with a great lobbying tool, which we can use to approach governments and call for action and set up the evidence as to why we're calling for action. And you never know, maybe your organisation, the chief medical officer's network might be interested in what we're doing.
Yeah, so absolutely. This is a group that I'm very proud to participate in, where physicians who are involved in some kind of industry get together to tackle social issues. And we've addressed this, and Sally, you and I were talking about that. Well, listen, Sally, you mentioned the use of antimicrobial products, disinfectants, antibacterials, so on and so forth, for treating surfaces. And of course, there's also hand sanitizers. Everyone knows about hand sanitizers now. I've heard some experts say that, you know, you shouldn't use these because they contribute to the development of antibiotic resistance. What are your feelings about that?
Oh, it's a difficult issue, and I don't think we will ever fully resolve it. I mean, I think if you look at biological plausibility, and I'm sure you'd agree with me, is that if you work in a laboratory, of course there's a link between exposing microbes to antimicrobial agents and them developing resistance. You know that because you know living cells, and anything you do to stress living cells, they will react by developing defense mechanisms. You know, that's what they do. But it's about putting it into perspective, because even though you can see it happening in the laboratory, there is no good evidence that using antimicrobial agents in our homes, disinfectants and so forth, is contributing to development of antibiotic resistance in practice. There's no good evidence at the moment yet. And I think that's the key thing, that maybe this evidence will be appear in the future. But what it says to me is that whatever the situation is or is not, we must use disinfectants prudently. And by prudently, I mean as part of targeted hygiene. And in this way, targeted hygiene provides us with a means of making sure that we use disinfectants where they're needed and not overusing them in places where they're not needed. And in fact, if you look at it from the other perspective, not using disinfectants where they're needed, for example, you know, with COVID, if you can wash your hands, providing you've got access to soap and water, because obviously the soap detaches the organisms, it's the water that takes the organisms off the hands. The soap only kills a small number. It's the rinsing situation. But there are lots of situations where we can't rinse our hands. And this is shown, you know, when we're on public transport, when we're on aeroplanes, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where hand sanitizers are absolutely vital to us. The same when I'm talking about the chicken in the kitchen. We can rinse the utensils, but we're left with the countertops. We can't rinse them. So in those situations, we need a disinfectant. So there's definitely need for disinfectants. And by using them in a targeted way, they can contribute to reducing the antimicrobial resistance problem, because fewer are getting infections and turning up in the doctor's surgery demanding antibiotics. So it can contribute as opposed to deflect. But it's got to be targeted use.
Yeah, it makes absolutely perfect sense. So you mentioned a little earlier about transmission of infectious particles and foodstuffs. So earlier in the pandemic, people were encouraged to clean their groceries before using them. In fact, a couple of scientific contributors to TV shows made videos about how exactly you should wash tubs and glass bottles and fruit and veg, either with a bleach solution or hot soapy water. Recently, viable virus was recovered from packages of, I think, frozen chicken and shrimp, as I recall. What are you recommending people to do? And here's the acid test. What do you do?
What do I do? This is a really good point because people are, you're overreacting here. But I don't think we are. And the thing that is interesting about COVID to me, if I dare digress a little bit, is that it's given us an unprecedented opportunity to explain targeted hygiene to people. Because, you know, there's been so much publicity about the journey of the germ, you know, that people have been told that, you know, how if someone's infected, how do they spread it? Because they produce aerosol particles. And if someone breathes those aerosol particles in, then they will become infected. So that's why we need social distancing. That's why we need masks, blah, blah, blah. And then that the other way is that either these particles can settle onto surfaces, or if we are infected ourselves, we can touch our infected membranes with our fingers, gets onto our hands, then it gets onto surfaces, and then people touch those surfaces, they pick it up and they become infected. So there's a fairly clear sort of picture that's emerging. But of course, one of these things is thinking about it when you go to the supermarket. And very early on, when we really didn't know what was going on, if you think about it, the supermarket was the one place where we all, you know, still had to go. What do we do in supermarkets? We touch things. That's what we go there for, to touch things and pick things up. So the idea that we should be going to the supermarket, we now put masks on, obviously. We sanitize our hands before we go in. And hopefully, if we happen to be the person who's infected, 1 in 2,000 of us, I believe, is still infected and carrying it around and infectious. That stops us from depositing organisms onto the packaging that we're touching. And then obviously when we leave the supermarket, we can sanitize our hands in case other people haven't been complying. And when we get home, what do we do? You know, if other people have been touching that packaging, well, then we could pick it up. So from that point of view, early on in the pandemic, when I was very unclear what was going on, this thing was spreading like wildfire, as you know. We went from 10 cases to zillions within about 3 weeks. Then I was bringing all my stuff home. I was quarantining it, anything, you know, that I didn't need and anything I needed to use and, you know, packaged, I would rinse it under a cold tap and put it away. I actually stopped doing it now. I live in an area where there's very low levels. And although I'm doing everything else in terms of social distancing and so forth, it is one practice that I've thought, okay, I think I can let go of this. If I was living in Bolton, however, I would still be doing it most certainly. So it's all about, you know, assessing risk. But I don't think, I use a story which I think is interesting. You've seen this story recently about, you know, 20 people coming over on planes and being infected.
Yeah.
Which I think tends to make me understand that the public still haven't grasped it, nor have the people who are trying to get us back to their businesses. Because if you see the way in which that airline company reacted, it was with outrage. They said, you know, we have got a world-class air filtration system on our flight, and we deep clean our aircraft between each flight. But the one thing I hadn't really thought about it, that the 90% of the risk is when people start clambering on board, 200 people clambering on board. And if one of those is infected, which happens, then that's the recipe for disaster. And from what I can tell, people on that flight were saying the cabin crew then did nothing. They'd done their bit. They deep cleaned. They got rid of the dirt. That aircraft was safe. What they didn't recognise was the important thing was what people were going to do once they got on that side. So instead of facilitating hygiene behaviour, they just seemed to sit back and do nothing. They should, you know, there should have been tannoy announcements saying, stay in your seats, please don't move around unless you have to. If you go to the toilet, please sanitise your hands before you go so that you're not touching seat backs. And even when you return to your seat, you may have washed your hands in the toilet, but then you're then touching all these seat backs on the way back. They should have been cajoling, coercing. I don't know. You know, we're seeing so much work being done in schools and when we go into restaurants to help people, to facilitate people, to make it easier for them to practice hygiene. But we don't seem to have got the message yet in that you can't make anywhere COVID secure. You can facilitate security, but you can't make anywhere COVID safe. So sorry if I digress, but I think that's important, don't you?
Yeah, I do. There's something else that I've been involved in, which is to, and maybe I'm dense, but I love the idea of testing people before departure. And it's sort of like we have security. You know that you're in the gate area with people who don't have guns or knives or bombs. Why not people who don't have the virus on board? And, you know, if you put, you know, cabin crew, flight crew and passengers on board, all of whom have been tested, all of whom are negative. Yes, no test is perfect, but then you've got pretty good biosecurity as well as terror, anti-terrorist security. But yeah, I guess more of that another day. There's something that you said to me, actually, there were many things you said to me that caught my attention, but you said, let's discuss disgust. So I love that phrase, Sally. Can you talk to us about that?
I think it's talking about barriers to change, because if we're going to get people to change their behaviour, we've got to get rid of the barriers to them changing behaviour. And one of the barriers is disgust. There's a group at the London School of Hygiene, which I'm obviously involved with, under Professor Valerie Curtis. And she, for many years, has been looking at how to change hand washing behavior in developing countries. It's all very well giving people sanitation or clean water, but if they don't wash their hands, really, it's all for nothing. So she did, for her PhD, she did a lot of work as to about what motivates people to wash their hands to make them clean. And she found there's obviously things like nurture and peer pressure and your place in society. Clean people are at the top and dirty people are at the bottom. But one of the strong motivators was disgust. And her theory is that, in fact, we're genetically programmed to avoid things that are disgusting. And you can see how that works, because in hunter-gatherer times, when there was open defecation from animals and from humans, a child that looked at poo that was lying around and said, "Ugh, that's disgusting, that's smelly," and avoided it, was one that was more likely to survive and spread on its genes. So they believe that disgust and the avoidance of dirt is something we're genetically programmed to do, which is fine for the world that we were living in then, where the main problem was gastrointestinal diseases, which were spread by, you know, poo getting into water and people drinking that water. But times have changed now, and we're talking about airborne diseases and other types of diseases in this more artificial world that we're in. But the trouble is that I think we're still being motivated largely by disgust, not by our understanding of the journey of the germ. So that's why, you know, I've been returning to it again and again, that it's so much when we go out and talk to people and ask them what they do, you can see underlying this all the time is their desire to say germs are, you know, where are the dirty places? That's where the germs lurk, and that's where I need to focus my cleaning. So we've somehow got to overcome this disgust reflex and modify it. But perhaps you could tell me how we could do it.
I'm not that clever, but I, you know, some of your turns of phrase really stick in my mind for sure, and I hope the listeners as well. The journey of the germ, that's another one. And following on that theme, there's a difference in how children are brought up these days. I've heard mention of the hygiene hypothesis as the reasons why things like food allergies and autoimmune diseases seem to be so prevalent. And I think this follows on nicely from what you were just saying. Yeah. Can you explain this this hypothesis, and is there any truth to it?
This dreaded hygiene hypothesis misnomer. Well, the thing is, it's the prototype theory for something that is true, which is there's a link between microbial exposure and our immune system. But perhaps I could leave the hygiene hypothesis as its prototype and talk about what we've now come to accept, or most experts have come to accept as the form of this, which is called the old friends hypothesis. Which is basically saying that the microbes we need are the ones that we were exposed to in hunter-gatherer times when our immune system was evolving. Things like the organisms from other people, things like organisms from our natural environment, but not necessarily organisms that are harmful to us. They're just the organisms that are around us. Graham Rook was the one who came up with this old friends hypothesis, and he has a nice analogy, which I think makes it easier to explain what we're talking about. He said we should liken our immune system to a computer program, in that we are born with a complete computer program, i.e. our immune system, but it lacks data. So what is key is that from our life, right from the moment we pass down our mother's birth canal to her nursing us, breastfeeding us, going on to interacting with siblings in our family, going outdoors and in sampling our environment, that what we're doing is to pick up organisms from all of these sources. They become established in our gut and in our on our skin, our respiratory tract, as the human microbiome. But one of the key functions of these microbes is to program our immune system such that our immune system, once it sees the molecular structures on the surface of a harmful microbe, it reacts and says, oh, right, okay, to this I have to mount an immune response to deal with that infection. But it also programs the immune system to say, wait a minute, these are tissues of my own self. I mustn't attack the tissues of my own self. This molecule that I've got, I'm being exposed to, is a food. It's a food that's harmless to me. It's a peanut. I must not react to that. Oh, the thing I'm inhaling is dust and pollen. It's not harmful to me. I must not react. So it's all about the immune system ignoring or tolerating what Graham Rook calls the forbidden targets. And of course, the problem is that if we change our lifestyles, as we have done, obviously we are reducing our exposure to these essential microbes. And we've now backed up this theory by plenty of epidemiological studies which show that there is a link. For example, there is a link between the cesarean section, people who opt for cesarean section, and the appearance of allergies subsequently in their children. So we've seen links between, you know, we have proved the links between these issues. The problem is that what we've got to do is to try and tease out which ones are the more important and which ones are not. But the one link we haven't proved is that that cleanliness in our homes contributes to this, you know, over what people are talking over cleanliness in our homes is a contribute to this loss of exposure to microbes. If you look, you know, we've done lots of studies on what goes on in our homes. And you can clean your home all you like, but so long as there are people and the windows are open and there are dogs and cats in the house, those microbes immediately return within an hour or so. There's no good evidence that that hygiene and cleanliness contributes. If it contributes at all relative to the other factors, its contribution is very small. But we're lumbered now with this thing called the hygiene hypothesis, because that was the prototype, because the first suggestion of this came from a guy called David Strachan, who noted that children from larger families were less likely to develop allergies. And he said, this is probably because they're less exposed to infectious diseases. And maybe this is happening because of improved household cleanliness and household amenities. What shall I call this? I think I'll call it the hygiene hypothesis. Well, of course, if it's not infectious diseases, it's not hygiene, because hygiene is what we do is to prevent us from exposure to infectious diseases. So you'd say, okay, hygiene hypothesis gone. But of course, the problem is that the name has stuck. And whether we like it or not, the media still want to call it the hygiene hypothesis, and so do many experts who really should know better than this. Well, we call it the hygiene hypothesis. If it's misleading the public, well, it doesn't really matter. So this idea of the link to hygiene is being perpetuated round and round and round again, and it's a big barrier to change. And again, I don't know how we get rid of it.
It's like any other form of misinformation. You just need clear communicators, of which you are clearly one. So I think we need to see and hear more from Professor Bloomfield. There's another group of drugs, the microbiome, growing evidence of the role it plays in a range of diseases. Can you give us a few examples?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the microbiome, but what I do know is that as the years have gone by, particularly since the 2000s, you know, our knowledge of the importance of the microbiome to our health, you know, has grown exponentially. So, you know, it's not just talking about allergies and autoimmune diseases. It's now beginning to be talking about maybe links to Alzheimer's, maybe links certainly to mental health. And so it tends to put us in a completely new world now, in that, you know, we've got to start saying, you know, we live within our microbial world. We are part of our microbial world. It is part of us and we are part of them. Trying to separate us from our microbial world is no longer an option. We have to, you know, recognize how to protect ourselves from those that are harmful, but recognize how we can embrace those that are good for us. And we've always said, okay, you know, this is our genetic makeup. And if something goes wrong with our genes, then this can cause this disease or that disease. But essentially who we are is governed by our own genes of our own cells. We're now saying, you know, there are millions of cells inside us, many more cells inside us that are microbes than there are human cells. And they add a huge genome to the living body, and that genome expresses itself. And so, you know, we're not just made up by what happens to our own cells. It's what happens to the microbiome cells inside us, which fundamentally affect our health. So it's a whole new ball game.
Yeah, I, you know, there's a number of products out on the market that I rail against that, you know, it's like pseudoscience. You put a $100 or £100 word into a sentence and suddenly it's validated. So I think, you know, it's something we'd love to talk about more on this podcast. You know, Sally, I always like to close by asking my guests some version of this question. Let's assume that you wake up tomorrow and you discover that you are appropriately the hygiene czar for the world. What three things would you do?
Hygiene czar of the world. Right, okay. I know what I would do is that I would leave no stone unturned, and I need a nice big budget to find a David Attenborough of the microbial world. If you think about the last 30 or 40 years, David and his colleagues have done a huge amount to reintroduce us to our natural world, that we are part of it and it is part of us, and how we value, obviously, that there are the lions and the tigers we have to avoid, but, you know, to learn to value and to recognize and to understand and to enjoy our animal world. We need someone to do that with our microbial world, to reintroduce us to the wonders of our microbial world, that they're our friends, most of them are our friends, that we need them, they're part of our health. So that's my biggest wish, that I would like to see, you know, microbiological science being something that's fascinating, not something that we want to brush under the carpet and not talk about. So that's my main wish. Well, the second thing is, if I would ban the use of the word germs, because I think it's when you think about the way in which it's misused in order to turn us off from germs. You know, children are brought up with the idea that they are nasty, disgusting, they've got horns and legs and you know, they giggle about them, poo and disgust and so forth. So it's infiltrated into us as children to dislike our microbial world and to avoid it. So I think that would be my second, probably my third which is something roughly the same. I would ban all newspapers from publishing these pieces to interest the people by saying, we went into somebody's home and we did this sampling, and this is where germs love to lurk, and help you to banish and get rid of the germs in your home. If I hear anyone else tell me that there are more germs on a chopping board than there are on a toilet seat, which is all the time bringing it back to disgust, and then this debate about the 5-second rule. If you drop the toast on the floor, is it safe to eat it? Again, it's, oh, the drawer is going to be where the germs are. So those are, maybe I haven't got a sense of humour any longer, but...
Well, Sally, I have to tell you, there's a program called Mythbusters, which I love. And one of the experiments they did was they did drop a slice, I think it was a slice of toast, and then they would plate it out to see if there were any bugs growing on it. Turns out 5 seconds, 10 seconds, you're golden. I guess it depends on how hungry you are. You know, I think the first of your wishes about there being a David Attenborough for this space, I think that's a completely unnecessary wish, because I think the David Attenborough exists and it's you. We just need to get you out there more talking about this. I hinted at the start of our chat that I wanted to go to bed tonight less dumb. And because of your wisdom, I shall. Professor Sally Bloomfield, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's been fun.
Yeah, it has indeed. Well, that's all from us today, but please join us next Friday for the EMG Health Podcast. Until then, stay healthy, stay clean.